I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The following podcast is hashtag Boone approved. It's time for another edition of the Brett Boone Podcast.
Remember when me and you almost went to blows? Lou sent me down three times too, so I know what you're talking about.
With your host, MLB All-Star, Brett Boone.
Bottom line is, you will become a successful major league hitter by hitting pitchers' mistakes.
As he sits down with his sports and entertainment friends from around the world.
You are not going to be a successful major league hitter if you hit pitchers' pitches.
This isn't just any former jocks podcast.
To change the outcome, you got to change the income. You got to change what goes in. Then that changes what goes out.
Often duplicated, but never replicated. Just like his bat flip.
Okay, now the party starts. The responsibility starts now.
Now in its fourth year, this is the one and only Brett Boone Podcast.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I'm Brett Boone, and today on the program, I'm joined by a 2001 All-Star, three-time World Series champion. He's currently hosts the pre- and post-game for the Houston Astros. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mike Stanton. Mike, thanks for coming on the program.
Booney, hey, it's my pleasure to be here. I appreciate you reaching out, and let's talk a little baseball, man.
It's been a long time, and once we played against each other for a long time, but I don't think we hooked up that many times. You were that lefty that went to the lefty,
right?
So
you were the power hitting right hander with the big swings. So they didn't really want the left hander facing me, anyways, or the right hander facing me facing a right hander. So there you go.
I want to talk bullpens a little bit.
Sure.
You were part of some pretty good ones. Braves, Yankees. I'm looking at your career and I'm thinking, man, I played for the Braves 1 year in 99. You ended up beating us in the World Series in New York. But you were part of some pretty darn, I think dynasty type things. Braves, obviously, of the 90s, they won a division every year. Yankees, you really don't have to go that far back to find out what you guys did winning all those World Series in that short time frame. Bullpens then, bullpens now. I remember as a player back then, a lot of the times we'd have our pregame meetings and think how we got to find a way, whoever was on the mound tonight, we got to find a way to get into that bullpen. The way things have changed up to 2024, they put a lot of money in the bullpen.
Sure.
Not necessarily you were a starter in the minor leagues, turn you into a pen guy. A lot of guys are getting drafted as pen guys now. Mm-hmm. Your take on how it's progressed from the 90s to current?
Well, yeah, I was blessed. Like you said, I was blessed to be part of many good bullpens, even great bullpens, and especially in those years with the Yankees. You know, what makes the bullpen? Well, it all starts with the closer, and we had the best closer in baseball history in Mariano Vera behind, myself and Jeff Nelson and Graham Lloyd and, some of the other guys that we had in those bullpens. So when you got a guy like Mo behind you, you're pretty good because you know that there's always somebody that's going to slam the door. But it really has changed. I mean, we've seen the salaries keep going up and up for starting pitchers. We've seen the salaries go up for relievers, but the emphasis on bullpens now is really higher than any other time. I've always said back when I was playing and since that the sign of a good bullpen is a good rotation. You know, if you're having to, cover, you know, 10, 11, 12 outs every single night, you got to have like seven or eight guys down there that, are dudes that can, do the job. And there's just simply, there just aren't bullpens that are built that way, but that's how it is now. I mean, you know, most of the time you have a guy at the top of your rotation. Yeah. He may give you six. He may, you know, go a little bit deeper than that, but that's going to be about it. And then the guys in the middle and the back end of the rotation, you're really looking for five and dive. And so that's a lot of outs that have to be covered on the bullpen on a nightly basis. And, you know, I think that's why salaries have gone up so much for relievers, because the emphasis on relievers, on bullpens, is higher than no other time in baseball history.
Isn't it amazing? You mentioned five and dive. I mean, back when we were in the beginning our careers, you five and dive, that was like, you don't want to be attached to that in any right. way, shape, or form. That is the norm now. Sure. I mean, and you know what? I don't look at it. I don't want to be the get off my lawn guy who's better when we played. No, there's so many great things that are coming from the game now. Of course, we're going to have our biases and think, yeah, it was pretty cool when we played. But that being said, I don't blame it so much on the young kids coming up today. It's the culture. It's how they're taught. Give us five, and we'll get into that bullpen who we've planned around. And like you said, you've got seven, eight guys down in the bullpen now. That wasn't always the norm either. A guy, you're in Houston right now. You cover that ball club, and they've got a little bit of a dynasty going on. Speaking of dynasties, a Verlander type. He has that mentality. He's one of the few. He's one of the oldest guys in the league. You know, he's at the end of his career, but he's one of the few, I think, and you get to see him a lot more than I do, but he still has that mentality because he came up when he did is when I take the ball, I expect I'm going to pitch I'm going to pitch nine innings today. Right. Now, obviously that doesn't usually happen, but you see guys like Verlander, Scherzer, he's getting older now, but that type from that generation, you still see that mentality of I'm going seven, eight, nine innings.
Yeah.
Whereas the generation that came after that, that's kind of gone. It's five and here's the ball, Skip. Here's what we're playing.
I've done my job. And we've even heard, you know, major league pitchers actually say that. I can't remember who it was.
Kirby yes, with the Mariners.
That's right. That he actually, I shouldn't have been out there anyways. Wait, huh? What? Oh, right. Your job's not to predict when you're supposed to pitch. Your job is to go out and pitch until they take the ball away from you. And your mentality should be, I'm going to finish what I started. Right. And that's really what it was in previous generations. But that's not how these guys go through the minor leagues. That's not how it's approached. It's not approached that way at the big league level. And it's really driven by the analytics. It's driven by the data. You know, you pitched against some really good pitchers back in the 90s and 2000s. And, you know, when did you get those dudes? Well, you're really looking to get especially the top of the rotation guys. Right. You're looking to get those guys in the third at bat. And that's where they don't let these guys face them. And that's what the data says. Let them go through the lineup twice. Then from there, we're going to go batter to batter through the third time. And you're rarely going to have anybody go four times through unless you're, you know, literally throwing a shutout. So that's, you know, the data says start running the relievers out there. And that's why I think the threshold for the Hall of Fame on wins has already gone down from 300 to 250. And I think it's going to go career wins. It's going to go even below that because starting pitchers just simply don't spend enough time on the mound to have big win totals. There's too many outs that have to be covered on a nightly basis that have a chance to blow the game or at least get a no decision. So, you know, the things have changed remarkably over the last, you know, 10, 20 years on just how the game is run on a day-to-day basis. And the analytics, that's what's a big driving force in today's baseball.
It's amazing. being on a team, watching a starting pitcher, there was that you've got to get through five innings to get the win or the loss.
Right.
And man, I'll tell you what, if you're in trouble, you got the lead in the fifth and that skipper comes and takes you out. I mean, those are fighting words.
Yeah.
Back when we came up, it's like, this is my game. You don't, nowadays, right. It could be 5-4 in the fifth. Nobody cares.
That's
give
right.
Give me the ball. You're coming out.
The pitcher walks off and says, you know what? I did my job. And you get to the dugout and everybody's patting you on the rear end, you on the back. Nice job. Nice job.
I try to teach the young kids. I said, listen, when you get your ass kicked, that's not a high five. That's maybe a pat on the butt. Hey, right. Get them next time.
That's right.
If I strike out for the third time, that's not a fist bump on my way back to the – that's a, hey, Booney, rough one.
That's
get them tomorrow.
That's the pat on the shoulder with the little glare on your face, like, ooh, that's a tough day.
Right, exactly. But they don't. It doesn't matter. I mean, nowadays I see at all levels. The pitcher will come out of the game in the seventh inning. It's 14-9, and it's right. Just high fives everywhere. I'm like,
that's right.
That is not a high five. That's a hang with them.
That's
but,
it.
But you're right.
Well, you know, they didn't do that with me because if I'm coming off, you know, in my minor league career, I was actually a starter. And even if I had thrown the ball well and I'm coming out in the seventh inning or something like that, I've left a couple guys on or, you know, I've given up a home run. You don't want to be around me. I was right. Not a pleasant, I did not take failure very well. And I'm not proud of that, but that was just the competitive side of me. I expected. You know, I had a early in my career in Atlanta. Charlie Liebrandt was a starting pitcher they had brought over from Kansas City, and it was one of the veteran guys that kind of helped us solidify and get that long run through the 90s, get it going. And you know, Charlie was a guy. I don't know if you ever faced Charlie, but Charlie was a guy that we'll just be nice and say he didn't throw very hard. I mean, he topped out at like 82, 83. You could catch him with the second baseman's glove, though. I mean, he could just hammer nails with just about every pitch. He knew where everything was going. Right. But he was a guy that would give up hits. And what Leo Mazzoni used to say, Charlie was a guy that would bend and not break. I think he had a start one time. He went like seven innings. He gave up like 12 hits, but didn't give up any runs. You know, always was able to pitch out of it. Didn't walk anybody, but they just hit the ball. He got a lot of base hits. So he would bend and not break. And I remember coming off the field one time, and I think I went three up, three down, might have struck out a guy. But, you know, threw a two-strike pitch right down the middle. The guy smokes it straight to an outfielder or, you know, one of the infielders, whatever. Get him out. And I get to the dugout, and I slam my glove on the bench. And Charlie waits a minute. You know, he was a veteran. He knew not to mess with somebody right away. And I'm sitting down next to him, and he goes, dude, why are you mad? And he goes, I said, what do you mean, why am I mad? I just gave up a freaking rocket. He goes, yeah, but you got him out. I said, Charlie, I expect to get everyone out and dominate everyone. He goes, that's not realistic. Well, I said, I know it's not realistic, but that's my thought process. My thought process is perfection. And when the perfection didn't happen, I was ticked off about it.
I'm telling you, I could relate wholeheartedly with you. For me, on the offensive side, when I was a young player, it was about that. I'd make an out, a bullet, great or bad bullet, out. I'm snapping.
Uh-huh.
And after a while, you know, you learn as we go on through our career and you get a little experience. I come to appreciate years later, I thought, wow, that little flare break my bat in three pieces and it's a knock.
Right.
I'll take that all day long. But it's something we go through as players.
Sure.
It's a maturity process.
I played with Paul O'Neill.
Some of us takes a little longer.
So Paul O'Neill was like the ultimate snapper. And he grinded every single at bat. The worst thing you could say to Paul, still to today, is, hey, you know, it all comes out in the wash. They all even out.
Right.
And oh my gosh, he will snap even today when you say that to him. Because listen, Paulie squared up the ball most of the time. And he would hit, you know, he wasn't a big power hitter. So a lot of line drives to outfielders and you know, just hard hit balls for outs. And he was so fun to watch at the end of the bench because he couldn't contain himself. He had to let it out. The best one wasn't when he would come in and start throwing his helmet. The best one would be when he would come in and he tried to control it. And he would sit at the end of the bench. Every muscle in his body is tense. And like five pitches later, he just screams as loud as he could because he just couldn't contain the frustration anymore. But yeah, Pauly, big time hitter. But I understand, you know, we should be perfectionists and we should look at the game. Now, later in my career, there was still the same anger, but there was also a side of me that was realistic, knowing that I can do everything right. I can execute the pitch. And since you're holding the bat, you got a chance. There may be, there's hits out there. It's why they're called holes in the field, that there's hits out there that, you know, just happen because of the way the game is played.
Isn't it amazing, though, having that mentality that you had as a pitcher, you give up the rocket, it's still an out. Now, that's as right. A veteran player, I'm going to look at you like you're crazy. Stan, you got the out. You did your job. Right. Give it a rest.
Right.
How we got it done. But having that mentality, you probably had a tough time with teammates. Like,
sometimes.
Right in that gray area. No, not. I'm talking about when it came to what I'm going to set up here. That gray area of, all right, he pitched three. Gave up one, shouldn't have given it up, but did. He technically did his job. So is this a high five or a pat on the ass type of situation? You're in between because you know how you think. You know that you don't want guys coming up to you when you don't think you did your job. You don't want high fives. Don't high five me. Don't appease me.
Yeah.
So I'd say
my teammates learned to read me as I came off the field.
Okay.
You know, I had a certain walk, and the funny thing is my mother to this day, she just turned 84 yesterday, to this day, she can tell how I'm feeling by my walk. And my teammates learned that. Said, if I have a certain look on my face, if I have a certain gait when I'm coming off the mound, leave me alone. That's not the time to come up for a high five.
All right. You get to see this on a regular basis. The new velocity. I'm watching, I watch more the offensive side. Of course, sure. I watch the pitching side. Of course, the velocity is up from 1992 when I broke into the game.
Right.
Your thoughts watching the games day in, day out. Are the guns different? We know the velocity's up a couple ticks. Is it up as much as they say it is? Or do you think that's more for radar guns? Radar guns sell tickets. Everybody likes it. I mean, hell, exit velocity as a hitter?
Mm-hmm.
We never thought about exit velocity.
Right.
We know that ball smoked, and I don't care how fast it is.
Yeah.
Now it's all about that. You know, the guy could be in a slump, and, well, he's averaging 97 on his exit. I don't really care. He's 0 for 10. But that's the way the game is now.
Right.
So do you think it's significantly different on the velo side, or do you think it's something that's just more, no, that's what we sell?
No, I think that they are throwing harder. There's no doubt. And they're throwing, and it's not that, you know, back in the 90s, we didn't have anybody that threw hard. I think what it is the average velocity is higher, that there's more guys that throw hard. You know, you have very few guys that are pitching. You know, there was the average fastball velocity in the early 90s was probably 90. You know, I mean, you had guys that threw harder, but you had guys that could pitch in the big leagues and threw less. There's not very many Kyle Hendricks out there. Okay. Just because they're not going to get the look because of the insistence of the radar gun and the data. Well, this guy doesn't have the right the spin rate. This guy doesn't have the right depth on his breaking ball. And I think that I'm hoping that we're actually kind of coming around full circle a little bit and saying that we're starting to pay attention more to pitchability now. Because one of the things that I see across Major League Baseball, these dudes throw hard, but they got no clue where the ball's going. You know, that's what pitching is still real estate. It's location, location, location. You know, whether you're throwing, 85 or 105, if you don't know where it's going, it's going to be hard to use. And, when we came up, I came up a little bit before you did, a couple years before you did. But, you know, even back then they were talking about, it doesn't matter how hard you throw, it can come out of a howitzer. If you throw it down the middle, the hitters can hit it. Well, we see that. We see 100 miles an hour turned around all the time. And that's because of location. And, you know, they see enough of it, you know, it's really not that extraordinary anymore. But I think we're starting to see a little bit of turning back the clock some, that the pitchability side of it is coming back. You know, big league velocity, you know, that's one of the problems they have in, with bullpens is, you know, there are bullpens out there that every freaking guy that comes out is 6'5" and he's throwing 100.
Right.
Okay. But if everybody's throwing the same speed, the Texas Rangers have had this for many years in the past, that everybody that comes out of their bullpen is throwing with velocity. They're all over the top. Now, they're not exactly the same, but there's no real change of eyesight as far as how they pitch and where they pitch from. And one of the things that, you know, AJ Hinch, back when he was the Astros manager, and you can see it even with the Tigers now. They just played the Tigers. The Astros just played the Tigers yesterday, and I called the game on Space City Sports Network or Space City Home Network. Let me get that right. And AJ always liked diversity from their bullpen. Yeah, I might have nothing but right-handers, but no two right-handers are the same. I might have a guy that's high velocity, high, you know, riding fastball. Then I got the guy that's kind of funky from the low three quarters sink. I got another guy that throws the high fastball, but he's got the dirty breaking ball. That's what he's going to attack with. And I think that messes up hitters more than just velocity. You throw it hard, it doesn't matter how hard it is. Eventually, somebody's going to get the head out.
Well, I'll tell you this. Velocity, if you could put it where you want, yeah, it's a plus. Sure. Best pitcher I've ever faced, and you played with him for a lot of years. For my money, and Pedro was unbelievable for years at a time. Roger Clemens, I want to mention him. Randy Johnson's the best left-hander I've ever faced. But for me, for my money, the technician, the best, every time I faced him, he was never bad.
Right.
He might have an off day for him, but he was never bad.
Yeah.
And that's Greg Maddux.
Who else?
Doggy threw, they always talk, well, Maddux, you know, the people now, they talk, well, he threw 87. No, Maddux, he'd get up there 93, 94 anytime.
Not when he won the four Cy Youngs. He was probably pitching in the low 90 to 92, 93.
Right.
But, you know, in those.
He's the best I've ever seen. He's the best I've ever seen.
And what made him the best? It wasn't. Now, he had the stuff was moving all over the place.
Right.
He had command of everything. So what was the difference between Tom Glavin, Hall of Famer, Greg Maddux, one of the best right-handers to ever take the mound?
Right.
I mean, those 4 years that he won the Cy Young, absolutely. Do you know he did not give up a three-run home run in those 4 years? That's incredible.
My son's in the minor leagues right now. I try to explain what it's like facing Maddux to him. Yeah. I said, he's different. He's just different. I faced a lot of great pitchers.
Right.
Doggy was always different than everybody else.
Yep.
Just a little bit different. He had the ability to put it in a window.
Yep.
And for the normal guy, when he missed, he'd miss by 6-8 inches. Greg would miss by an inch and be pissed about it.
And be mad. Put his glove up over his face and drop an F-bomb.
For those years you're talking about where he was winning the Cy Youngs.
Yeah.
I mean, if he went 7 innings and gave up 2, that was a bad outing for
sure.
him. You know, and I remember those days because I was in that league or in that Reds would come and play you guys.
Sure.
And I'd be like, no, I don't want to see this again. No. I'm going to get Maddux, Smoltz, Glavin like I do every time. I want Merker, and no disrespect to Merker.
Right. Avery.
He's a great pitcher.
Yeah.
But I don't want Maddux, Smoltz, Glavin because that's who I always get.
So the difference between the two, Glavin had tremendous control of one side of the plate. That was going to be arm side away from right-handers into left-handers. Okay. When he started throwing left-handers, the changeup, that's really what put him in the Hall of Fame. And he'll tell you that. Okay. But what made Maddux superior is his command of multiple pitches and command of both sides of the plate. You know, he was just as good throwing the ball away from a right-hander as throwing in. You know, his approach, and you probably can remember this, when there were guys on base, he went soft. He didn't throw the fastball. I mean, there was one time, actually, you might have played. Did you play with Ronnie Gant when he was with the Reds?
Yes.
Okay. So Ron Gant, you know, former Brave.
That had to be 95. You guys beat us in the postseason.
So, and Ron Gant came out of his shoes all the time. He was not looking to walk ever. And Doggy used to tell us, he goes, hey, there are times that I will set a hitter up. We were just talking baseball. There would be times I'm setting up a hitter for a 3-2 changeup. BS. You're not setting anybody up for a 3-2 changeup. Well, he had the bases loaded and he throws it. He just undresses Ron Gant on a 2-2 fastball. And of course, he does the glove. He drops the F-bomb. I think he did it completely on purpose. And by the way, the bases were loaded, and he threw the dirtiest changeup you've ever seen. Ronnie missed it by about 3.5 feet on a full hack. It wasn't like a breakdown swing, you know, because Ron was sold out on the fastball. After that, you go, he said, Greg, tip your cap. Because you just set somebody up for a 3-2 bases loaded changeup. It's got to be the right hitter. But that's what made Greg so good. He was never going to give in, and he had command of four, he had true command, meaning he can put the ball where he wants to with four pitches.
And contrary as a hitter, contrary to what people think, yeah, velocity is always it's always a positive to have that.
Sure.
But some of the best pitchers that I've faced through the years, the ability to subtract in a big situation, 3-1, 2-0, everybody wants to rear back and give you that best fastball. Well, what do you think I'm looking for?
Right.
So if you have the ability, if you're 95, sitting 95, and you have the ability in those big counts to give me an 89-mile-an-hour fastball, you'd be amazed.
Sure.
How off the barrel you'll get me.
That's right.
The best I've ever seen coming full circle was Bartolo Colon. He came up as a kid. He was throwing 98, 99.
Oh my gosh.
And 3-1, 2-0. We used to say that's the lightest 98 I've ever faced because it came off the bat. It wasn't heavy.
Yeah.
And when he started making that change and actually started kind of pitching like Maddox,
right?
That two seamer to the outside corner, which you mentioned Leo Mazzoni, that was his whole bag. That was your bag in Atlanta, his pitch away. And we'll get to him in a minute. But yeah, interesting. The ability to subtract instead of always adding. Because as a hitter, we're ready for you to add, especially when we're young hitters. That's not a problem for us cranking it up for velocity.
Right.
But if you have the ability to subtract when we think you're going to add, it's amazing how much success can be had with that.
I talk to pitchers all the time, you know, especially when you're talking, even amateur hitters, when you're talking about, you know, the middle of the lineup guys, you know, you're facing a seven hole guy in high school. All right. You can throw the fastball. He's not going to hit it, you know, 95% of the time. But when you're facing the three hole hitter, what does that dude want to be? He wants to be a hero. And this is one thing that Greg Maddux actually told us. He goes, they want to be heroes. So they're just naturally going to swing. So I'm going to feed off their aggressiveness by subtracting.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Pitch clock this year.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I think we all went into it. I know I did. I was very pessimistic about it. I didn't like it. I didn't like a clock being put in baseball. That's kind of, we hang our hat on. We don't have a clock. We're the only.
Right.
But once I saw it, I got to admit, I loved it.
Yeah.
Games were moved along. It seemed crisper. We were a bunch of dead time wasn't being wasted. I thought people, now I'd like to see the hitter get a little more than has to engage at the seven. Is it the 7 or the 8 second mark?
Right.
And then the pitcher can hold it on him.
Yeah.
And we can't call timeout. So I think as time goes on, they'll work that out.
Yeah.
What did you see on the pitcher side? Did you see any ill effects from a stamina position, anything like that, having to be ready to go, especially the guys that weren't quick workers going into this?
I think there were some pitchers that had more issues with it than others. I think for the most part, it was a non-factor. You know, one of the things that I noticed, and there was a report that came out, I want to say it was mid-May, came out last year, that the average time left on the clock when the pitch was being made, when the pitcher went into his delivery, was 6 seconds. That there was still 6 seconds left on the clock on average. And that was one of the things that I talked about many times was pitchers need to figure out how long 18 seconds or 20 seconds really is, that you have time. You know, you don't have to rush. And actually, we saw JV, Justin Verlander, towards the end of the season that year, last year, you know, he's almost looking at the clock to make sure he's using up the time because, you know, the hitter doesn't want to stand there and do nothing also, especially since he can't come out of the box and, you know, trying to manipulate the clock just a little bit. It dropped another 2 seconds. It's a non-factor. I don't think it's a big deal at all. But there were pitchers. You know, Houston has one that I think it affected Framber Valdez last year because Framber was a guy, you never saw the emotions, but he pitched with a lot of emotion. And when, you know, 2 years ago, he would step back and you'd see him take a deep breath and kind of really try and collect himself, get back under control and get back in there and execute his pitch. Last year, he wasn't able to do that. He didn't have the time to do that. And I think he struggled with that at times.
Moving on, I want to talk about the Braves and your career with Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I believe you're there from 88 to 95, went over to Boston that 95 season.
Correct.
I was there 1 year, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Played for Bobby Cox. Different than any other year I'd played. Had some good years with the Reds. We had a couple playoff runs a couple years later. It always ends with the team that Stanton's on too, by the way. 99, you beat us with the New York Yankees.
Right.
2001, you knock off my Mariner team. So it always, you were always on the, you were the X factor.
That was the 116 team.
Yeah, the 168. Yeah. Of course, you guys bumped me. Stanton's on the other end. Anyway, we'll get to that later. But 99, and you'd lived it already.
Mm-hmm.
You go from the Braves to the Yankees. But I noticed something different. I went into camp, and there were a couple new players. Brian Jordan and myself were the newcomers to the team. And it had Chipper and Ryan Klesko and Andrew and Maddox Smoltz-Glavin, the normal, the kind of that core that was there for a long time. And I remember Bobby having that talk and that first day of spring training, we all have it every year.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to the new guys, Booney, Brian, he goes, here in Atlanta, we win every year. He said, I'm going to put the lineup out. I'm going to expect you to go out and steamroll your competition because that's what we do here in Atlanta. I think that year we ended up winning 104 games. Different mentality than I'd have ever had or seen on any other organization I played for.
Yeah,
I remember going to the postseason that year, Mike. And I'd been to a couple postseasons, and you know, you have the shares meeting at the end of the season. Who's going to get what? Are we going to give anything? Well, I sit in this Atlanta shares meeting, and they're giving shares to the peanut lady.
Right.
And I'm going, Glav. And Glavin's running the show. And I say, Tommy, I said, what's going on, Booney? And he says, you know, laughing. He says, Booney, we go to the playoffs every year. You know, it's not a big deal. We like to take care of. And I'm looking around to the guys. You know, I'm one of the few guys that haven't been there a long time. I'm like, well I don't go to the playoffs every year. I don't think we should. And they kind of, you know, I was in the minority, obviously, in that room. But it was a different mentality.
Sure.
You saw that. You saw it in New York, where winning was expected. Talk about your time there and what you saw on that unbelievable run in Atlanta.
Yeah. Well, we started in Atlanta. You know, I go back to prior to Bobby Cox being the manager. So I came up in 1989. Russ Nixon was the manager. Halfway through the 1990 season is when Bobby actually went from being the general manager to being the field manager. And that's when they brought Leo Mazzoni in as the pitching coach. It was Bruce Del Canton prior to that. And, you know, through those first couple years, we knew we had a good team. They brought in some key free agents. Bobby had decided, and then John Schuerholz had decided, okay, it's time. You know, we've got the young talent. Now we need to bring in some veteran presence. And I mentioned Charlie Liebrandt was a guy. We brought in Terry Pendleton, ends up winning an MVP. The St. Louis Cardinals thought he was done. Juan Berenguer in the bullpen. Rafael Belliard at shortstop. That was before Blauser took over. Yeah. And what the Sid Bream at first base. And what these guys did, they just kind of got us all going in the right direction. And the rest was history. Through those first couple years, you really didn't feel like you were doing anything. You know, you were struggling just like everybody was. I think both seasons, but especially the 92 season, halfway through the season, we were like 500. You know, 91, same thing. I mean, we were an okay team through the first half. Then the second half happened. It was like we just simply didn't lose. That's when the tomahawk chop started. It was a good time in Atlanta, there in the real early 90s. And it wasn't until, you know, 93, 94. Now all of a sudden guys are getting a little bit longer in the tooth. You realize what you're actually going through and the expectations grew. We had the same thing in New York. In New York, they win the World Series in 96. I wasn't on that team. I was on the Texas Rangers. They actually came through us to win the World Series. I go over there in 97. John Wetland and I trade places. I go to New York. He goes to Texas. And but the mentality from day one was always different. And you talked about it. That was something that you really didn't talk about. You know, you knew you were a good team, but there's a lot of good teams. And and the expectation in New York, and everyone knows what the players said, what the organization said. But it's truly what was the mentality. If we don't win the World Series, then it's not a good year. And I had never been on another team that was the case. You know, 97, I think the reason why we went through the run, 98, 99, 2000, and then making the World Series in 2001, the first three winning those. So my opinion, the last baseball true dynasty, you got to win championships. You got to win back-to-back to do it, was – just that. 97, Mariano gives up the home run to Sandy Alomar Jr. To walk us off. He was playing for the Indians. He had an opposite field home run in this decisive game, and it was a walk-off home run, and then the Cleveland Indians ended up going to the World Series. But that stuck with us, and through the offseason, it was, you know, nobody had a, you know, he had a good offseason, but nobody had a great offseason because you always felt like there was something, we left something undone. We didn't finish what we started. And then 98, 114 wins. I mean, it was like we never lost. It was incredible. Once we got on a roll after about the first week of the season, and that's when it really started. But that carried – what happened in 97 carried on in 98, 99, and 2000. Had a great bunch of guys. For the most part, we got along. You know, there's obviously always some issues here and there. You don't put that many type A personalities together for 8 straight months and expect everyone to get along. But when we went on the field, everybody had one single goal, and that was the team win. You know, whatever I had to do, the team would win. Did we have the best pitching staff? No. There was other pitching staffs that on paper you'd probably say were better. Do we have the best offense? Probably not. There were offenses that you would say were better, but the collective as a whole, you just simply weren't going to beat us.
No, believe me, I lived it. And especially at old Yankee Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
And I know Jeter's always saying the ghosts will come out. You know, my brother played there a year. He goes, yeah, Jeter told me the ghosts would come out. I said, I've seen him a couple times.
That's right.
I've seen him a couple times with right. those weird home runs.
They, you know what, though? The Yankee organization played up to that big time. You know, you think it was a coincidence that they played the Yankeeographies during the visitors' batting practice every day? No. They're playing into the aura that was the legendary. You're playing the Yankees. You can play any other team, but they're not the Yankees.
Yeah. And I thought both of those teams were similar. I mean, especially when you got to the mid-90s. It was Maddox, Smoltz, Glavine, Chipper, Andrew became a fixture there. And then it'd be like they'd bring in a few players every year to complement that.
There's always a turnover.
New York, similar. I mean, you had the main guys with Posada and Jeter and Bernie. And you know, you talked about I just had to throw this in. You were talking about Paulie O'Neill earlier. I don't think Paul gets that as much credit as he should. I'm telling you, as an opponent coming to New York, you know, you hear about Bernie and you hear about Jeter and you hear about Alex in his day. I'm telling you, those meetings in the visitor clubhouse was don't let O'Neill beat you.
Yeah.
And it was that more times than not. It wasn't the guys you hear about all the time. Mm-hmm. It was don't let Paul O'Neill beat you. He was that big of a cog in that wheel.
He was.
And he's got all the rings, but you don't hear his name as much as you hear the other guys.
Right.
I think he should.
And the reason why, because he wasn't a big home run hitter. You know, he hit for a high average. He had a high on base percentage. But, you know, where Paul O'Neill made his money was actually on the bench. And I could tell you, playing with Atlanta, he's in Cincinnati. Now, you remember when he was in Cincinnati, he was a role player. You know, Lou Piniella didn't think he could hit left-handers.
Yeah, big
so O'Neill. But his intensity was something we missed. He retired after the 20 season. He retired after the, what was it? The 2000 season. I'm sorry, 2000 season. And I think in 2021, we missed his intensity. Because the dude was 40 years old. He's still grinding out every single solitary at-bat. You see him all pissed off at the end of the bench because he lined out yet again, didn't get his base hit. And I think we missed that in 2001. I hated him. Oh, I said, oh, my God, what a big freaking baby. Look at him on the bench. He's just, you know. But when he was a teammate of yours, you freaking loved him. Because if a 40-year-old can grind out an at-bat down by four in July, you know, in middle July with nothing on the line, if he's grinding out at bats, you fed off that hit, that energy.
You want him on your team.
Absolutely.
Two pretty eccentric owners too. you got any comparisons to the Ted Turner, Steinbrenner? I always looked at Steinbrenner as, you know, a guy on the other side thinking one day I'd love to play for the Yankees. Just, you know, on my way out, I always love coming to New York. It was my favorite trip because no matter what happened, I know it was going to be exciting going, especially playing at Yankee Stadium.
Yankee Stadium was going to be rocking and rolling.
Right. Playing at Shea, you know, it might be all right, but there was nothing quite like playing at Yankee Stadium.
Right.
You got any comparisons between the two?
Not really.
Eccentric.
Both very eccentric. Both very unique. You know, the one thing, and listen, you really didn't hear much from Ted. You know, maybe something in the paper, but he had so many other businesses going on. He's running TBS. He's got all this stuff. The one thing I always remember about Ted was in the 1991 World Series. We're playing Minnesota Twins. And we're in the Homer Dome up in Minnesota, the Baggy, and it's so loud that you can't talk. You know, if you and I were sitting next to each other in the bullpen, we couldn't have this conversation. Just the gray noise was that loud because it held a lot of people and it was a very small stadium. And he fell asleep. Ted fell asleep in the front row, sitting right next to Jane. He fell asleep in a World Series. He fell asleep. So that's the one thing. And that was kind of Ted's, you know, yeah, this is kind of cool. You know, in the 80s, he went down and he managed the game, you know, went down on the bench, put on the uniform and managed. Hey, he's the owner. He can do whatever the frick he wants. So, but George was the other man. George had as much competitiveness as all of us players did. You know, the one thing you say about an owner, you know, what do you want as a player? He was going to open up the checkbook,
right,
and help the team win, period. It didn't matter how much the player was. He wanted to win that bad. He got himself in trouble in the 80s because of it. But, you know, that was just one thing. And there's nothing. Yeah, you know what? He's going to say him and David Wells went back and forth. And, you know, he didn't like Arabu, Hideki Arabu at one point. But he was going to say what he was going to say. But when it came right down to it, if there was a part that your team needed to win, dude was going to go out and get them. That's all you can really ask for.
As a player, without a doubt, because I was on teams that did that, and I was on teams that didn't.
Yeah, you had March.
I had March. I'll tell you, March would make me turn in my cracked bats to get another dozen.
Yep.
But when push came to shove, she wanted to win.
Yeah.
So you put up with that. I look at a George, and I can handle sparring or George saying something about me on the front page.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, I think you guys knew that. When it comes crunch time, when it comes, that's all he wants to do is win. Yeah. And you see other teams that necessarily that isn't their first and foremost on the agenda.
But George liked you. He ended up loving David Wells. Okay. And the reason why, because did you get to play with Boomer?
I played with Boomer in Cincinnati for a year. Okay. He got,
so well, another very unique deadline guy. Yeah, yeah, very unique guy. Okay. But also a guy that was going to say what was ever on his mind.
Yep.
And it didn't matter what the forum was. It wasn't matter where he is. And there's probably going to be it doesn't. I just saw him the end of last summer. Yeah. We had the 98. We celebrated the 98 team. And it's the first time I had been back to New York. I don't know why it had taken me so long, but it was the 25th anniversary of the 98 team. Arguably the best team to ever walk on the field. Booney, do you know the numbers? We won 125 games that year.
Oh, it was ridiculous. Yeah, with the
on the ring, right. On the ring, it's sitting in the safe right next to me. On the ring, it actually says our record, which was 125-50. We were 75 games over 500 that year. So we celebrated that, and it was awesome. I mean, goosebumps the whole time I was there. But, you know, David Wells was going, and that, and George liked to confront people, and he respected you if you came back at him. And David went back and forth with him. He actually went up, and they had several meetings in his office that Boomer was not going to back down. And that's what George liked. George loved that. He had as much competitiveness as any of the players on the field.
Yeah. It's kind of a Lou Piniella mentality.
Yeah. No doubt.
Yankee, same thing. If he loved fighting with you,
right.
But if he respected you, that's a guy you wanted in your corner.
No doubt.
Want to move on to Astros. Last year, we expect the Astros every year. They were the pick. They were my pick once you got into it. Didn't end up working out a year ago. Lost to the Rangers, who ended up winning the World Series. Your take on being around the Astros on a daily basis. I look at that offense, and I talk about the last 5 or 6 years, because there were a few teams that I was on where I consider the offense to be very astute, where you see guys talking to each other all the time, and they're sharing information about this pitcher and that. It's right. Just high-level hitting, and I love to watch that. That's what really, even to this day, you want to talk the mental side of hitting and how to prepare and looking for tells for pitchers. That's right up my alley. I can talk all day about it. Mm-hmm. I've watched this team for years now. They seem to be that high intellect when Bregman and Altuve when Correa was there, it's like they're all sharing information. They all have an idea of what they're doing. And it's a really good team. Now you throw in an Alvarez and a Tucker, two studs to that. Talk a little bit about their run last year, coming up short.
Yeah.
I know you're starting this season off with your big guy, Verlander. He's going to be in the IL to start the season.
Right.
You talked about Valdez having to maybe make an adjustment to that pitch count. How do you look the opening? How do you look at the last year's disappointment?
Yeah.
The opening of 2024.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So they got to be the team to beat again in the West, even though they did. Well, they did win the West last year. They tied the Rangers, but they had the Astros had the tiebreaker. So I think that, you know, I talked about the Yankees 97 going into 98, getting knocked out by the Indians. And then that offseason, how things just weren't right. That you did, you know, you just did not have a settled feeling about how the season went. And that carried over into 98, 99, 2000. I think you talk to the players this spring, they have that same feeling that they felt like they left something on the table. You know, it wasn't a great season they had. They had their ups and downs. You know, this is a team that is a very, very good offensive team, especially on the road. For some reason, over this run that they've had over the last 8 years or so, they've been better road team than they have been home team. Can't really put your finger on it, or you try and fix it, but they, you know, then they're continue to try and fix it. But I think that's what they feel right now, is that the sound that we've heard from spring training, everybody's having a good spring training. It's been a quiet spring training for the Astros, but there's still just that stuck in your craw a little bit, just something little there that you know, we didn't finish what we should have finished last year. It's been an incredible run. Actually, they coined it last year, the Astros did, that this is the golden age of Astros baseball. And it absolutely is. I mean, they've had good teams in the past. You go back to the late 90s, early 2000s. We had the Killer Bees and guys like that. Nothing like what they've had now. And it's truly remarkable. What another similarity between this team offensively, the Astros, and the Yankees, you know, what did the Yankees do back in the day? They didn't really beat up starting pitching. They beat up relievers. And it wasn't usually back-end relievers. It was that 10th, 11th guy on the staff, because they would knock the starting pitcher out after five innings. Then you have those extra outs that we started off talking about. They weren't a high strikeout team. They were a high walk, high on base percentage team. That's what this Astros team is. In this day and age where strikeouts are just another out, that we have MVPs striking out 200 times.
Yeah.
This is not, and it hasn't been a high strikeout team. This is a team that knows their strike zone, especially guys like Bregman, Altuve. Altuve swings at everything. But Bregman, Yordan Alvarez, Tucker, you know, Michael Brantley retired, but when he was it, these guys know their strike zone tremendously well. You know, if Bregman comes back and says that ball, even if it's called a strike, that ball's an inch off the plate. The ball was an inch off the plate.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. And that just puts that much more pressure. If you're not going to swing out of the zone, I'm only going to swing in the zone. That's that much more pressure on the pitching staff, because a lot of times your swing and misses aren't at strikes.
And I do. I think that this Astros team offensively is the most astute offense in all the game. Now, you can argue, you know, talent levels. I mean, you can go over to the Dodgers. The Dodgers say, wait a minute, we got Ohtani, Betts, and Freddie Freeman. Okay, right. Well, I can argue with you about talent back and forth, but I'm talking about just intellect, astuteness. I've always...
And as a whole. A lineup as a whole, their approach is always
smart.
Make the pitchers throw strikes. You know, as simple as that seems, if you're not going to offer as a pitcher, if you're not going to offer out of the zone, man, my options are limited, especially with the way, again, we'll go back to how we started the podcast, with the way pitchers don't throw strikes now. I mean, now all of a sudden, you only have to get a few hits to score runs, because you're going to have five or six walks to go with it.
Hader comes over from the Padres, had another, you know, 1.something ERA crazy. A year ago. Presley's got
he's not going to be the full-time closer.
Right. I would assume they're going to do a little ham and egging out in that.
Astros are extremely conservative with their players all the way around. You know, Bregman played 161 last year. He won't do that again. And nobody else probably played over 150 games. Everybody, now they have a lot more off days than we do. They have actually 10 more off days than when you and I were playing. But even with those off days, they're going to get additional off days. You know, these guys are going to play 150 games. So there's going to be other off days, and the relievers are the same. They're not going to go. They don't like to go 2 days in a row. They'll do it, but they don't want their relievers absolutely are not going to go 3 days in a row. So there's going to be saves out there. Hader's not going to have every save. You know, Presley's going to get some saves. Brian Abreu will get some saves. You know, there's going to be other times because, you know, they kind of have the same approach that the Braves did when you were talking about the Braves and we win every year. You know, my Yankees, when we were doing our thing in the late 90s and early 2000s, we're looking at October. We're looking at September and October. I want our dudes on the mound, ready to go, healthy, sharp then. And that's all that's going on with Verlander. I didn't touch on that earlier. There's no injury with Verlander. They're just going slow. You know, the dude's 40 plus years old.
Yeah.
You know, they're not looking at 30, 32 starts out of him. If they can get 25 starts out of him, they're going to be fine. And he's healthy at the end of the year, then that's success.
Maldonado moves on. Young kid Diaz takes over. How does that affect it? Is there any effect there from what you've seen from him?
Well, last year was, and even Martin knew that this was, you know, he was mentoring Yiner Diaz. And Yiner Diaz is a very talented player. Offensively, he's legit. He made some big strides last year. Now, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of an unknown, but I think with all the work that he did with Maldonado, with the Astros last year, you know, being the backup guy, not catching all that much, that was all time him just learning how the Astros attack, you know, the pitchers. You know, this is a very good pitching staff again, but very diverse pitching staff. You got guys throw a whole lot of different stuff. And, you know, we know that the Astros are one of the most analytically driven teams in Major League Baseball. So there's a lot of information that has to be gone through and decide how you're going to use it. So that's what last year was about. I suspect he's going to be just fine. But we'll have to wait and see. It's just one of those things that you really just, you can't put your finger on it because it hasn't happened yet.
And the one thing, and then we'll move on from the Astros. Give me an update on McCullers. It's like, what's going on? Is he ever going to pitch again? I have no idea. People forget. You know, you look at the rotation. It's Valdez, Javier, Urquidy, Hunter Brown, and everybody forgets. I said, and it always hits me. I go, wait a minute. Where's McCullers? When's he coming back?
Middle of the season. There's no real hard date. You know, it's unfortunate because, you know, this guy has, I mean, we saw it years ago with him throwing, 24 breaking balls in a row to finish off the Yankees. He's got one of the best breaking balls, changes speeds with it, changes shapes with it. But, you know, the contract that he signed, is he going to pitch again? Well, they're going to give him every opportunity because he still has a long time left on that contract. I think two or three years after this one. So he's going to get the opportunity, but it's unfortunate because talented young man just has not been able to get on the field and get that arm right to where he can go out there and be a successful pitcher. So no real hard date right now. They're just talking about middle of the summer. We'll just have to wait and see.
Move over to Texas. Texas Rangers won the World Series a year ago. No Montgomery coming back. DeGrom's still not back. Scherzer's out. Had back injury. He had a back surgery in the offseason.
Yeah.
Evaldi's still at the top of that rotation with Gray. Lost Garver to the Seattle Mariners. What'd you see last year? What do you expect out of them this year?
Great run. I mean, tremendous offensive team last year. I think that's going to be really hard to duplicate. And then they had a couple pitchers that just got on a roll, and Montgomery was one of them. I have a tough time believing they're going to be able to duplicate that. You know, Adolis Garcia has already had some physical issues this spring, so he's been out some. You know, Seager, what an incredible year he had. Should have won the MVP. He was there with Shohei. But just an incredible season. Again, going to be hard to duplicate. So we'll have to wait. So I think they're still going to be a good team. The question's been what the question was last year, and was their pitching. And I think last year they just kind of everything lined up for them, and they ended up playing really well down the stretch in the playoffs because they weren't playing very well coming out of September. I think the team to watch and the team that everyone's concerned about in the American League West is the Seattle Mariners. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the talent they have in their rotation. You know, they got J-Rod, they've got some good offensive players, but they have the ability in their rotation to shut any offense down. And if those guys can figure out and stay healthy and not shoot themselves in the foot in April and May, like they've done the last couple of years, dig themselves big, big holes, and they have all summer to try and get out of it. They can be a very dangerous team.
I think I look at the Mariners on paper, and I really kind of discarded from that. And I don't mean disrespect, but I don't think the A's are a factor. And I don't think the Angels are a factor either. They haven't done enough this offseason to show me any reason that they can compete with the top three you just mentioned.
Not going to be able to pitch. That's been something we have talked about for, I'm going to say, and I'm not exaggerating, almost a decade. What do the Angels need? Pitching. What do the Angels need? Pitching, 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 pitching. And what do? They go get another hitter.
I'll tell you the Mariners rotation. I was just over in Mariner camp a few days ago. That's as good a rotation, I think, as there is in the game.
Sure.
And this Miller and Wu kid that finish out the four and the five spots, if these guys are what I think they are, just from the eye test on the stuff, they're in for something. Because Castillo, Kirby's really something special. If he wins a Cy Young one day, that's not going to surprise me.
Right.
The only thing is, you look at that offense and year in and year out, second base has been a hole. Well, they go out and they get a Polanco from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They plug that hole. You lose Teoscar Hernandez and you lose Suarez at third base. That's 190 RBIs, but you replace them with some guys that aren't going to strike out 200 times.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see how these guys come to fruition. But you're right. Mariners are a dangerous team.
And listen, every team goes into the regular season wanting to get off to a good start. I mean, that's the standard, and it's true. But what you want to make sure you don't do is bury yourself. Play 500 through the first couple months of the season. Now you're going to be fine. Now you're in the race. Yeah, you're in third place. Doesn't matter. Other teams have gotten hot, but if you do at least that, you give yourself a chance. But we've seen them so many times over the last couple of years, be 12, 13, 15 games under 500 by the time you get to the midsummer. And every year they seem to kind of bounce back and they're at least in the conversation by September, but you burn so much energy just trying to get back to relevancy, which is 500. I mean, everybody's got a run in them. You don't want that run to get back to 500. You want to get that run to get 14, 15 games over 500.
Right. What wins that division? How many games? What's your call?
I think with Oakland having some issues, basically rebuilding, I don't think the Angels are going to have a whole lot of wins. They may be 500. I think that would be a good year for them. With the new schedule, which is you're playing everybody across Major League Baseball, including both Central Divisions, which are still a lot of wins in the Central Division. Yep. I think we're probably talking about 97, 98 wins.
97, and to me, you're talking 97, 98 wins, and I'm still on board with the Astros. Astros are still the team to beat. I thought they were the team to beat in the postseason last year. Mm-hmm. They got knocked out. Kind of shocked me a little bit, but man, it just seems like this core, it's not going away.
Yeah. And like I said, it's a little different attitude in that camp here in spring training that they felt like they had unfinished business from last year. And the last time I was on a team that happened, the team won three World Series in a row. Now, I don't think that's a tall order, but could they get back to the World Series here in 2024? I think they very well could.
Without a doubt. Mike Stanton, I appreciate you coming on, went a little long, but it was good stuff.
Booney, my pleasure, man. Anytime. This is what I do. I talk baseball.
You heard it. We both think
my wife is so sick of it.
You heard it here. We both like the Astros to win the division. 97 games. It's a lot of games, but hey, it's been done before. For all you watching the Boone Podcast, we're new to YouTube. Appreciate you tuning in. For those of you listening, it's a pleasure, and we'll be here. Until next time, I'm Brett Boone, Mike Stanton. Have a great day.
Adios.